Okay, here we go. Jacob went on his way after leaving Laban towards the promised land. Remember the vow he made to God? That was also still in force. If the Lord will be with me as I travel and bring me back, then the Lord will be my God. And some angels met him, undoubtedly to encourage him. So Jacob sent some messengers to Esau that he was returning. And when the messengers returned, they said to Jacob, Esau's coming with 400 men. Picture in your mind a company of 400. That's a lot of men. And Jacob had no defenses. He had sheep and women. So Jacob divided the people into two companies. He reasoned if Esau gets one company, the other one might escape. Then he spent some time in prayer and reminded God of the promises God had made to Jacob. So he spent the night at a place called Mahanaim, and he prepared a present for Esau. Then they began their travels, and he was behind the two companies at this point. And then that night, he sent his wives and children across the Jabbok, which was a stream, and so he was alone. Okay, that's where we are right now. Now we're on page 124 in your notes. And verses 22 to 25 in chapter 32. 22 to 25. It might not be 22. Okay. Actually, that should really be, that's not really 22 to 25. That's a mistake. It's actually 24 to 32. That's where we are right now. 24 to 32. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. So this wrestling match must have lasted like 8 hours. That's a long time to wrestle. When he, the man, saw that he had not prevailed against him, Jacob, he touched the socket of his thigh, so the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. Now, who do you think that man was? It was God. He was wrestling with God. He'd been wrestling with God all his life, and now here was the climax. Then he, this man, said, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking. But he, Jacob, said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So now Jacob knows who it is. So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." He, the man Jacob was wrestling with, said, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel." And Israel translates "he who strives with God." So as you can see, the name is associated with something that's happening in the life of the person who's named. Then Jacob asked him and said, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it you ask my name?" And he blessed him there. So Jacob named the place Peniel, which means the face of God. For he said, "I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved." Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel. And he was limping on his thigh. Now, he limped the rest of his life. He now had a limp. And we'll talk about that. There's some meaning to that. "Therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh in the sinew of the hip." That's not in the law. It became a custom in Israel. Okay, now in the notes, Jacob wrestles with the angel of the Lord. So right away we give away who it is. Before Jacob could cross the Jabbok River after his family, servants, and provisions, a man attacked and fought with him. No details of the fight are given, for it was just the preamble to the most significant part, the dialogue. In other words, the story of this wrestling match, the significant thing about the wrestling match was not the match itself, but the conversation between the two combatants. The word "is a man" reveals nothing about his identity. This is fitting, for the man refused to reveal anything about himself directly. The fact that the match lasted until daybreak is significant, for darkness symbolized Jacob's situation. Fear and uncertainty seized him. If Jacob knew that he was about to fight God, he never would have engaged in the fight. So apparently at the beginning, he just thought he was, you know, wrestling with a man. But quite clearly, at some point during this wrestling match, possibly the dialogue they were having, Jacob came to realize it was the angel of the Lord. On the other hand, the fact that the wrestling continued until daybreak suggests a long, decisive bout. In fact, the assailant did not defeat Jacob until he resorted to something extraordinary. At last, the assailant touched Jacob so that his hip went out of joint. The assailant gave himself the advantage. I don't know if anybody here has had a dislocated joint. You're completely crippled, especially if it's the hip. I've seen people... I used to be on a gym team when I was in school, and I've seen people have their shoulders dislocated, and it's never happened to me, but they just lie there in pain. And one of the things about a dislocation is you've got to get it back in the socket as quickly as possible before it swells up and you can't. So I do remember this one fellow was doing the rings, you know, the rings where they swing and stuff. And he fell down and his shoulder was out of joint. And he was just lying there in agony. And a man came running over. And he started moving his arm and his shoulder around. And this poor fellow was in such pain. But he got it back into the joint. Now, of course, that wasn't the end of it. You know, he had to heal and stuff like that. And there may have been other damage in there. But a dislocated joint is debilitating, especially your hip. Can't even walk. At last, the assailant touched Jacob so that his hip went out of joint. The assailant gave himself the advantage. Jacob, the deceitful fighter, was crippled by a supernatural blow. And that says something, because apparently that's what it took to have Jacob have a change of heart. He was a very, very stubborn man, at least up until this point. Okay? Once he realized who his assailant was, and we get that when you see verse 28, where it says, "He said, 'Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed.'" So now he knows for sure who he's wrestling with. He's wrestling with God. Okay. At last the assailant touched Jacob so that his hip went out of joint. The assailant gave himself the advantage. Jacob, the deceitful fighter, was crippled by a supernatural blow. Once he realized who his assailant was, Jacob held on resolutely, pleading for a blessing. When we remember that in the Tanakh, a person's name reveals his character, the point becomes clear. Jacob's way of life had to radically change. In saying his name, Jacob had to reveal his whole nature. Here, the heel catcher was caught and had to confess his true nature before he could be blessed. And I know that my name has never been changed. God's never changed my name, but I know that I've spent more than a sufficient time wrestling with God in my life. And the only, you can't win a wrestling match with God. It's not in the cards. But what you can do is submit to God. That's the only way out of a wrestling match with God, is submit to God. Because if you don't, you're going to be wrestling your whole life long and profit nothing. Okay? The blessing took the form of a new name, Israel. This name probably means God fights. The explanation was then given that Jacob had fought with God and with men. It is easy to comprehend as having fought with men, but that he fought with God was more difficult to understand than it is. You know, we can picture it, but first of all, we would have to say, number one, when this man, who was the angel of the Lord, was wrestling with Jacob, he wasn't putting all he had into the match. That's clear. However, what he was doing was he was wrestling with Jacob as a man would wrestle with Jacob, and as a man, he couldn't beat him. It was just like they wrestled all night long, and the wrestling match didn't go anywhere. So when the daybreak came, the angel of the Lord, we now know who that is, said to Jacob, "Let me go," and Jacob wouldn't let him go unless he blessed him. Throughout Jacob's life, he had been dragging God's blessing out under all circumstances under his own steam. He was too self-willed and too proud to let the blessing be given to him. So now, God Fights was his name. This meant, first of all, that God chose, because of Jacob's stubbornness and pride, to fight against him. Second, it meant that God would fight for Israel. If the Lord saw it as being important enough to have an all-night wrestling match with Jacob, there's more to it than that. And many times God has fought for Israel. Jacob's new name would remind him and others of this fight in which he had overcome. The words were full of hope for the Israelites. If one could contend successfully with God, he could then win the battle with men. And remember who this is being written to. This is being written to the Jewish people who are about to go into battle. Thus the name God Fights and the explanation that Jacob had overcome obtained the significance of a promise for the nation's forthcoming struggle. Okay. Now, Jacob's going to walk with a limp the rest of his life. And it might seem as though that's kind of harsh. But there's something interesting in Matthew 5 that helps us to understand what's going on here. Matthew chapter 5. Malachi. Here we're in Matthew chapter 5, and I'm starting from verse 27. Look what it says and see how you can relate this to what happened to Jacob. You have heard it, that it was said, "You shall not commit adultery." But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Now, of course, the Lord was speaking hyperbole. You know, he's not literally saying that if you have a problem with pornography, pluck your eyes out. He has other solutions to that. But he's just showing us through this little teaching that he's doing the absolutely devastating effects of sin in our life. And so I'm sure that when we see Jacob in heaven and say, Jacob, you had to go the rest of your life limping, he said, was the best thing that ever happened to me, because it resulted in a change of character for him. And it was better for him to limp the rest of his life and be a man of integrity than to go on living the way he had been living for the first part of his life. Okay. Now, Jacob named the place Peniel, which means the face of God. So we want to look at verses 30 to 32. So all kinds of things go through my mind. Like, I'd like to say to Jacob, what did he look like? Is he strong? You couldn't beat him, but he couldn't beat you. It looks like it was a tie. So I've been wrestling with God for many years now. And one thing I've learned is there's no winning. You can't win. You can't win a wrestling match with God. It's simply not possible. And it's not because of how powerful he is. It's because when we wrestle with God, we're actually wrestling with ourselves. And we defeat ourselves. And of course, I'm using wrestling with God somewhat metaphorically now. But I think we all have times in our life when we wrestle with God, when we know what God's will is, but we let our will prevail. That's when we wrestle with God. And sometimes it takes a wrestling match with God to show us his way is the better way. Okay, so verses 30 to 32. I got to get back to Genesis. I'm still in Matthew. So Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel, and he was limping on his thigh. I read that already. But I'm reading it again because we have some things to say about it. Let me just check something. Yeah. Therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh and the sinew of his hip. By the way, think about something. When it says here, therefore, to this day, when was that? What day was it? I don't mean Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, but where in the history of Israel was it? They'd come out of Egypt, right? The Exodus had taken place. Wait, where am I? Oh, wait, I'm not thinking right. Yeah, wait, yeah, you're right. I'm not saying when did this take place. I'm saying when did Moses write this? And he wrote it to Israel, to the Jewish people, who had just come out of Egypt and were now going in and were going to conquer all the nations in the land. And so this would have meaning for them. I think the best meaning it can have for them is without God they'll lose, with God they can't lose. Okay? Okay, Jacob named the place Peniel because he had seen God face to face and had been spared. As before, he named the place to commemorate an event. God had come as close to Jacob as possible. He had laid his hands on him. The idea of this is, and is not, and yet he was spared, but rather, and his life was spared. He had prayed for deliverance using the word nasal, which means save me, the same word he would use later, nasal, spared. He would use it in the past tense. And in verse 30, he says, so Jacob named the place Peniel, and that translates to the face of God. For he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. So Jacob's prayer for deliverance was answered by God in this face-to-face encounter and blessing. When God touches the strongest sinew of a wrestler, and that's the muscles of your hip, and especially the tendons that connect it's called the femur bone up here to your hip bone, they're the thickest, strongest tendons in your body. When God touches the strongest sinew of a wrestler, it's shriveled, and with it, Jacob's persistent self-confidence also shriveled. His carnal weapons were lame and useless. They failed him in his contest with God. See, what Jacob had to be shown was he was a mere man. And how many, not of us, but how many people live as though they're not mere human beings? They make themselves their own God, and they walk around with a self-confidence that is really misplaced. And in doing that, they miss out on God's blessing in their life. What he had surmised for the past 20 years now dawned on him. He was in the hands against the one whom it is useless to struggle. After this crippling touch, Jacob's struggle took a new direction. This is not something, an isolated situation either, don't forget. When Moses left Egypt, why did he leave Egypt? Anybody know? What caused Moses to leave Egypt?
Killing.
He had murdered a man. He was a murderer. How long did Moses have to stay in the wilderness for God to change his character? 40 years. That's a long time. That's a long time. But I'll tell you something. If somebody is, for example, a compulsive liar, it can take 40 years for them to even know that they're doing it. It becomes such a natural part of their life. When I was growing up, I was pretty wild, to say the least. And I used to lie to my parents a lot, because I'd go out and do something crazy, and they'd say, what did you do tonight? And I would just say something like, go to the movies, when I was really out, doing things that I wouldn't want to tell my parents. And it got to the point with me that if I was going out, and let's say I was going to the movies, and my father said to me, where are you going tonight? I wouldn't say to the movies. I was such a compulsive liar, I'd make up some story. Because it became a habit that as soon as my father asked me, where are you going and what are you going to do, right away I had to defend myself. Very bad place to be, very bad place to be. Especially lying, because lying destroys a relationship. You cannot have a successful relationship if one of the parties to the relationship is a liar. It's just totally impossible. It can't be done. The point of the story for the new nation of Israel. Oh, let me see something. Okay. The point of the story for the new nation of Israel that would come from Egypt into the land of promise is clear. Israel's ultimate victory would come not by the usual ways by which nations gain power, but through the power of divine blessing. Self-sufficiency is incompatible with the work of God in any age. Faith alone overcomes the world. And that's something that's been true since the creation of Adam and Eve. Some things just never change. And, you know, we have this tendency to look back in time and to look back to the times of men like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That is, if you even believe they existed. Many unbelievers don't. And see them as cavemen because they lived so long ago. These were not cavemen. These were brilliant men. I mean, they didn't have computers and all that stuff. But these were, I mean, read some of David's Psalms, you know? And it's very interesting. I've always noticed it's very interesting that if you go back in time to just right after the Dark Ages and go into the Enlightenment, and you measure the human race's advances in technology, they're certainly astounding. But we have not advanced in the arts at all for centuries. There are no Leonardo da Vinci's alive today, you know? And so, you know, where Abraham lived, the city he lived in, they had air conditioning. That's pretty advanced. Now, of course, it wasn't like we have where you plug it into the wall, but they used water to cool houses. They had cool streams, and they constructed it in such a way that the streams would, I guess, I don't know how they did it. Maybe they had built some kind of pipes that surrounded the interior, between the interior and exterior wall of the house and kept the house cool. So these were not by any means what we would call cavemen. These were brilliant men. Solomon is the wisest man to ever live, aside from Yeshua, of course. Okay? Yeshua, Jesus. Okay. And that's the reason it's wise to follow God's instructions in our life. That's the wise way to live. And of course, how do we know his instructions? We read the Bible. It's foolhardy, to say the least, to read the Bible, read the instructions that are in the Bible, and decide, I think I'll do it this way. There's no profit in that at all. Okay, chapter 23, Jacob's reconciliation with Esau. So we're in chapter 23. 33. Yeah, Genesis 33. And we're going to read verses 1 to 7 first. Then Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. Can you imagine what that must have looked like? 400 men on horseback, riding in the desert, would kick up a dust storm. Excuse me? Camels, right. Well, they had horses, but you're right, camels or horses, whatever. You could see the dust storm before you saw the men. Then Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. He put the maids and their children in front, and Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. Let me stop and show you something that's very interesting. If I can find it. In Genesis, is it 27? It can't be that far back. In Genesis 27, we have a good picture of Jacob. Now, therefore, this is Rebecca. Rebecca said to her son Jacob, behold, I heard your father speak to your brother Esau, saying, bring me some game and prepare a savory dish for me, that I may eat and bless you in the presence of the Lord before my death. Now, therefore, my son, listen to me as I command you. Here's wisdom in a woman and a man, both of them. Look at his plot. Go to the flock and bring me two choice young goats from there, that I may prepare them as a savory dish for your father, such as he loves. Then you shall bring it to your father that he may eat, so that he may bless you before his death. You see what they're trying to do here. They want to steal Esau's blessing as the firstborn. Jacob answered his mother Rebekah, "Behold, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me. Then I will be as a deceiver in his sight, and I will bring upon myself a curse and not a blessing." And you know the rest of the story, how she had him put on some of Esau's clothing so he would smell like Esau. And she put, whatever she did, she made it so that when Jacob touched his arm, his forearm, it felt like Esau. I'm not sure exactly how she did it, but something that was hairy or so forth. And Jacob and Rebekah stole the blessing from Esau. And that's when Esau's, you know, that's when Esau was so, you know, first he takes, you know, my birthright for a bowl of porridge, you know, so selfish. And now he's taking my blessing. I'm going to kill him. I'll wait till my father dies and then I'll kill him. But Rebekah heard that he had said this. And that's when Rebekah said to Jacob, "Go live with Laban until your brother's anger has subsided." Okay? But let me just go over a couple of scriptures with you that are very interesting. In Genesis, let me start reading again from verse 33, because I want to get a smooth flow. "Then Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. He put the maids and their children in front, and Leah and their children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground seven times until he came near to his brother." Now, what I wanted to show you is, go back to chapter 32, okay, right before the wrestling match. And look at verse 18. Well, let's start with verse 17. "He commanded the one in front," this is Jacob talking to one of his men, "when my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, 'To whom do you belong and where are you going? And to whom do these animals in front of you belong?' You shall say, 'These belong to your servant Jacob, is a present sent to my lord Esau, and behold, he is also behind us.'" So Jacob was all the way at the back, right? Now he has a wrestling match with God. And we go over to chapter 33. And look what it says. "But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground seven times until he came near to his brother." So we can see the change that's taking place in him. He's no longer cowardly and selfish. "Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. He lifted his eyes and saw the women and children and said, 'Who are these with you?' So he said, 'The children whom God has graciously given your servant.' Then the maids came near with their children and they bowed down. Leah likewise came near with her children and they bowed down. And afterwards Joseph came near with Rachel and they bowed down." Okay, so let's go to the notes. Something else I want to point out, though, that's pretty significant. Look at the change that took place in Esau. Here he's ready to kill him. And I don't know, they say time heals all wounds. If somebody really is that, I can understand getting so angry at someone that you want to kill them, and then a week later, you don't anymore. As a matter of fact, that's one of the arguments that the anti-gun lobby uses. Here's what they say. It's very interesting. If Let's suppose we're in a living room together. I get so angry at you that I want to kill you. So I pick up a baseball bat, intending to beat you with it until you die. And you run out the front door, and I'm running after you. And after a little while, I just slow down a little bit. And I say, what am I doing here? I have some time for the rage to subside. With a gun, it's not like that. I get angry at you. Boom, you're dead. There's no time for the rage to subside. So anyway, that's one of their arguments, that you can kill somebody with a baseball bat. You got to chase them down, and it can take a number of minutes. With a gun, it can take a few seconds. Anyway, in John 15:5, we're going to take some scriptures and link them together and see how they relate to one another and how they relate to what Jacob's going through. First thing we have to realize, I am the vine, you're the branches. He who abides in me and I in him, he bears much fruit, for apart from me, you can do nothing. And that's literal. Apart from God in our life, we may as well just lie down and let a truck run over us. Because there's no purpose. There's no purpose in life unless you're serving God. Okay? Now, this change in Esau. Now, we don't know anything about Esau's life from the time he said, I want to kill my brother, until now, except obviously he prospered quite a bit, that 400 men under him. But go to Proverbs 21:1. And I think this will explain, at least in part, what's taking place here. God made a promise to keep Jacob safe, right? God knew that Esau wanted to kill him. But look what it says in Proverbs 21:1. The king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes. God can cause a heart to change. And obviously that's what he did in the case of Esau. So when we read this story, it's not necessarily the length of time that caused things to change, although that could be. Esau's anger subsided and so forth. But controlling the entire situation was God, and most specifically the promise that God made to Jacob: I will bring you back into the land. You will go out, I'll keep you safe, you will come back, and I'll bring you back to this land. That's why Jacob's fear was unfounded. He had no reason to fear if Esau had 10,000 men and still wanted to kill him. It was God said, I'm going to bring you back into the land safely. Now, I'm not saying I wouldn't be scared in a situation like that. I would. It's only human. But when you think about it, when we're in a situation where our back is against the wall and there's absolutely no solution, that's where God wants us, because he is our solution. And he wants us during those times to turn to him and say, God, I am helpless. Save me. And then he will do that, and our faith will be strengthened. And so it's very important for us, these sections of Scripture, and they were especially important to Israel. I mean, how about when they sent the spies into the land? And the spies came back and said, no, there's giants in the land. We can't go in there, blah, blah, blah. But Caleb said, no, we got to go in, and go in, there'll be no problem, because he believed the promises of God. And when you look later, Caleb was about 40 years old when the spies went in, okay? When they actually went in, and after they had conquered the land, Caleb came to Moses and said, I'm now in my 80s. I can go in and out just like I did in my 40s. Going in and out means going out to war. And I still have all my youth and all my vigor. and may I have this piece of land over here? And he's rewarded for his faithfulness with a piece of land. So trust in God is never misplaced. The only thing we have to be careful of is distinguish between trusting God and tempting God. We don't want to do that. We don't want to do that. The fellow who led him to the Lord once said to me, I asked him a question about something, and he said to me, I believe in God, but I wear my seatbelt. And even at my young age, I can understand what he was saying there. We don't want to test the Lord. We want to have confidence in the Lord. Earlier, Esau cared nothing for his birthright, and he cared little for old grudges now. Jacob, relieved because of Esau's hospitality, had to admit once again that more was due to God's intervention than he realized. Jacob makes ready for his meeting with Esau. Jacob still showed weakness and fear when he met Esau. He lined up his children and wives in order of their importance to him, with Jacob and Rachel in the rear, the safest place. Who, when, who, where? What letter are you? Yeah, Joseph, that Jacob should be Joseph. Thank you. Jacob bowed down to the ground 7 times in homage, thus halting on his way towards Esau. Esau, however, eagerly ran to meet Jacob and embraced and kissed him, and they both wept. What a change is made when God fights in his way. You know, without God, who knows what Jacob would have done? He'd have been all the way at the back. When he saw the men, he probably would have ran somewhere and hid in the cave and come out maybe a couple days later to see what carnage had taken place. But after the wrestling match with God, he was changed. He was a changed man. In talking with Esau, Jacob constantly referred to Esau as my Lord and to himself as your servant. Esau simply referred to Jacob as my brother. This contrasts with their father's blessing when Isaac made Jacob Esau's Lord. Jacob definitely approached Esau. In talking about himself, Jacob referred to himself as your servant and to Esau as my Lord. Jacob definitely, there's a typo there. I don't know how that happens. Jacob definitely approached Esau cautiously and humbly in an effort to ward off any possible retaliatory spirit. Okay, let me get back to Genesis now. Okay. Jacob's gifts to Esau. As you can see, both Jacob and Esau were, I guess, what you would call multimillionaires by today's standards. I mean, when we read, remember when we read this present that Jacob was giving to Esau? That present alone would make a man wealthy. So imagine all that Jacob had. He was just giving Jacob a little present. But it wasn't really so little. They were just very, very wealthy. Okay, Jacob's gifts to Esau, verses 8 to 11. And he said, what do you mean by all this company which I have met? This is Esau speaking. And he, Jacob, said, to find favor in the sight of my Lord. But Esau said, I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own. Jacob said, no, please, if now I had found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. You can see they've both changed. They're not the same as they were in their youth. You know, one of the theories in crime is the reason they give some criminals a very, very long sentence is because, like, when you're 19 years old and you're a criminal, you have the capability of doing some heinous things. When you're 90 years old, it's not that way anymore. All you want to do is have some porridge and go to bed. So time has changed these men, but more so God has changed both of their hearts. Okay. Verses 8 through 11. So anyway, in verse 11 it says, "Please take my gift which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me and because I have plenty." Thus he urged him, and he took it. Jacob pressed Esau to accept the gift of, should be the gift of 500 animals. When Esau hesitated to receive the livestock, Jacob insisted. Jacob's explanation that seeing Esau's face was like seeing the face of God, that's a simile, it's a figure of speech, showed he knew this deliverance of harm by Esau was from God. And that's something that we want to remember. I don't know about you, but it's not unusual for me to be in a difficult situation. Sometimes I find myself in situations that are just really beyond me. And one of the things I know that God wants me to do at those times, and he says this to Israel throughout the Old Testament, is remember. That's the whole theory behind having the Exodus, the Seder once a year forever. Remember what I've done for you. As a matter of fact, if you're ever really feeling down and you just have one of those blue days, you know what you can do to change your attitude? Find somebody and share your testimony with them. It'll bless you as much as it blesses them. Of course, you'll remember what God did for you. I can think back on my life to times that God did for me above and beyond what I could have ever imagined, based on the circumstances in which I found myself. Okay, so Jacob's explanation that seeing Esau's face was like seeing the face of God showed he knew this deliverance of harm by Esau was from God. At Peniel, Jacob had seen the face of God and was delivered. Having then survived that, he survived Esau. Thus, Esau's favorable reaction was brought about by God's gracious dealings. Okay, let's go to chapter 33, and we're going to read verses 12 through 17. Then Esau said, "Let us take our journey and go, and I will go before you." But he said to him, "My Lord knows that the children are frail and that the flocks and herds which are nursing are a care to me. If they are driven hard one day, all the flocks will die. Please let my Lord pass on before his servant, and I will proceed at my leisure according to the pace of the cattle that are before me, and according to the pace of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir." Did he go to Seir? No, he didn't. He still has this thing about him that he has trouble telling the truth, because he didn't go, as we'll see. Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built for himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore the place is called Succoth, which means booth. Okay, Jacob and Esau depart from one another. Jacob cleverly avoided traveling with Esau, but again, he was deceptive. He led Esau to think that he needed to travel slowly because of his young children and young animals. and that he would meet with Esau at Seir. But Jacob headed in the opposite direction, north to Succoth, east of the Jordan River and north of the Jabbok, instead of south to Seir. He may have been wise to avoid Edom, but it was not necessary to deceive his brother again. And so we have to remember our old man, old woman, is always ready to rise from the dead. They don't just disappear. Through faith they do, and they get worse with time. They get worse with time. You know, it's a very interesting thing. When you have somebody who's an alcoholic, right? And let's suppose that person is 25 years old. And their alcoholism, let's say we have an alcoholism scale, just some random scale. And on 0 to 100, their alcoholism is like 40. That's how bad it is. The higher the number, the worse it is. Then they go into recovery, and they don't take a drink for 30 years. Then they start to drink again. You would probably think that when they started to drink again, after all that time, that it would either, they'd start back at 40, or maybe be a little less than 40 because they haven't had a drink. That's not what happens. It's as though they never stopped drinking. They'll right away, they'll shoot right up to 80 immediately, because it's a progressive disease. And that's why we have to, it's very important that we're honest with ourselves about these things. You know, I amaze myself sometimes. What is the point of lying to God? But we do it.
We lie to ourselves.
I'm the king. Yeah, we do lie to ourselves. And we're very clever about how we do it. We rationalize. Okay, thus miracles were worked in Jacob and Esau. In Jacob, God brought about a spirit of humility and generosity. Esau was changed from seeking revenge to desiring reconciliation. These changes were proof that God had delivered Jacob in answer to his prayer. Now, the question is, how much do we believe God? Before I'll tell you a story that's true, before I became a believer, and this is going back like more than 40 years ago, this is when I was like in my late teens or early 20s, right around there. I was a drug addict, and I went with two of my so-called friends who were also drug addicts, and the three of us went and got some drugs and did them, and make a long story short, one of the three of us died, and it was, you can imagine how scared I was. It didn't stop me from using drugs, but I was very scared. First of all, his father was in the mafia. That's number one. So, and they were going to put a hit out on me. Second of all, the police thought I was the one. The police came up with this cock and bull story that I did it against his will or something. I don't know what they had, but things died down somehow and whatever. But then I became a believer. Sometime, a couple years after that. And I went to a seminar once, and I was talking to the fellow who was giving the seminar, and he said I should go to this man and ask him to forgive me. I said, okay. That might not have been the smartest thing to do. But I went and knocked on his door, and when he opened the door and our eyes met, I thought I was going to have a heart attack. I was never so scared in my life. But I went in and we talked, you know, and I mean, we didn't like hug or anything like that, but he and his wife told me we're not going to do anything to hurt you, and I left. I also went to the police because I thought, you know, the way we use those drugs is we use a syringe. I was of the belief that I had injected the fellow who died. And so I went to the police, and this was years later, but I said, I have to confess to something I did. So they sent me up to the detective's place, and I told them, and I said, when some years ago, fella died, and when I was called in, I just said, each of the three of us injected ourselves. But I was of the belief that I injected that fellow. So they sent me down to take a lie detector test. And when I took the lie detector test, the fellow asked me, you know, first he started with the usual questions, is your name Mark and all that stuff, to get a baseline. But then he asked me questions. He said, did you do this to so-and-so? And he asked me those questions. And he said to me, you're not telling me the truth right now. I said, but I am. Why in the world would I come in here and tell you these things if they're not true? And he said to me, I've been giving lie detector tests for something like 30 years. And he said to me, you are so burdened down with guilt that you are blaming yourself to the extent that you think you did it. That's what he said. And nothing came of it, of course, because when they went back and looked through the old files, they realized, you know. And that's what guilt can do to you. And interestingly enough, of course, my father found it. I told my father. My father was beside himself, what an idiot I am. But he said to me, you know something, I never told you this. You know the other guy who lived? He was walking around thinking he did it. Because he was so burdened down with guilt. So we have to be really careful in our lives not to let these things get the better of us. Actually, the best way to say it, we have to prevent ourselves from getting the better of ourselves. We have to let God guide us, because if we don't, we cannot go in the right direction. We cannot bear fruit, and all we can do is cause sorrow and destruction. I mean, look at the human race. The human race is extinguishing itself. Look what we're doing. I mean, think about this for a minute. The whole theory of evolution is based on the concept of survival of the fittest, right? I'd like to ask somebody from the who takes that point of view, evolution, a question. I say, wait a second. You're saying survival of the fittest, but the fittest are human beings who are destroying all life on Earth. There's some kind of contradiction in your thinking. If we're the fittest, why are we killing ourselves and every animal to boot? Now, anyway. Okay, so Jacob and Esau depart from one another. And I read the first part there. Number four, the settlement at Shechem, verses 18 to 20. These verses form a sort of epilogue to Jacob's sojourn outside the land. He returned in peace and camped near Shechem, directly west of the Jabbok River and about 20 miles from the Jordan in Canaan. This is where Abram first camped when he arrived in Canaan. Shechem was between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. Jacob, like Abram, purchased a portion of the land, and there, like Abram, set up an altar, naming it El Elohe, God is the God of Israel. Whenever you see in the Hebrew the word El, E-L is the transliteration, that's God. And then the word that comes after it is descriptive of something about God, like El Shaddai, you know, something like that. In this way, he acknowledged that the Lord had led him all the way back to the land. The following chapters shift the focus on the Jacob's children, his arrival back into the land, and his establishing of the altar, or the culmination of Jacob's Laban experience. Can I borrow your pen for a minute? Let's go to some. Thanks. Fix it. Okay, so what we're going to have here now is kind of the changing of the guard. It's going to move forward one generation. So I'm going to see some people who are going to die off, and then the brothers are going to grow into tribes. In this chapter, Jacob named the number of cities: Bethel, Galeed, Mahanaim, Peniel, and Succoth. Was named because of the sheds of the shelters he built for his livestock. Now, Succoth, they have here, I took this out of a commentary, it says shelters. I think a better translation is booths, which are shelters, but I think that's a better translation because that's what they actually were. They weren't like tents. They were more like booths. You've seen when we have one here every year? That's more what they looked like. The name of the altar he built there, Succoth, also commemorated the significance of God's relationship to Israel. Jacob's new name, God had protected him as he had promised. Now, one of the things we have to remember as believers, if we're walking with God, we're safe. Now, I didn't say if we're working with God, no tribulation and no persecution, but it's better to be walking with God and be persecuted than to turn our back on God and prosper in an earthly sense. Listen to Deuteronomy 31. Deuteronomy 31. And we're going to look at 6 through 8. Be strong and courageous. This is Moses speaking to Israel now, and we're coming to the end of Moses' life not too long from now, and Joshua will take over. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or tremble at them, the nations that are in the Promised Land. For the Lord your God is the one who goes with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. If only Israel had believed that. But they were left to their own devices. And then in Joshua 1:5, Joshua was quite a man, you know. But Joshua 1:5, this is what it says. No, this is God talking to God talking to Joshua, who now is going to be the leader over Israel. Moses has passed away. No man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. And this is something for us to remember in our own lives. For example, Hebrews 13:5. I'll show you something interesting about the Greek language. In Hebrews 13:5, let me get it. In Hebrews 13:5, now we English speaking people tend to treat English in a very similar way that we treat mathematics. More like a science than an art. And so, for example, we learn in mathematics, you may remember this, but if I take negative 6 times negative 3, 2 negatives make a positive. Remember that from math in high school? Okay. So we take this over into our language and we say, when you're writing in the English language, it's not permissible to use a double negative. And sometimes we do that, and the teacher, if you're writing a composition, the teacher will put a mark there or something. But I think that the Greeks and the Hebrews had a better perspective on language because they didn't treat it like such a science. They treated it more like an art. Now, in Hebrews 13:5,
This is what it says. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. You know what that really says in the Greek, if you translate it literally? It says, make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never, never leave you, nor will I ever, ever forsake you. Now, in the English language, that's not permissible. But in the Greek language, it's permissible because the writer wants to emphasize something. And when something like that is written in the Bible, we should really pay attention to it. If we go over to Romans chapter 8, one of my favorite chapters in the whole Bible. And in Romans chapter 8, look what it says in verse 18. Now, we all have troubles in life, but look what it says. I have an old expression I like to say. The worse it gets, the better it's going to be. And I base it on this verse, verse 18. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed in us. So when we're going through life and we have tough times, we can always take comfort in the fact better times are ahead. It's not possible that our difficulties can even be in the same ballpark as the glory that's going to be revealed in us. And then, of course, when we go over to verses 31 through 39, how anybody can believe, how anybody can read these verses and believe that it's possible for a believer to lose his or her salvation, I don't know how their brain works. Listen to this. Romans chapter 8, starting from verse 31. What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who is against us? He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him over for us all, how will he not also with him freely give us all things? Who will bring a charge against God's elect? God is the one who justifies. That's interesting. You know what that's saying? That's saying that the God who sent his son to die for us is the judge. And the prosecuting attorney, who is Satan, is bringing us before the judge with an accusation. And the father says to himself, this has been paid for already. Satan's accusations are futile. Who will bring a charge against God so that God is the one who justifies? Who is the one who condemns? Messiah Jesus is he who died. Yes, rather, who was raised, who is at the right hand of God, who also intercedes for us. And you know what it means to sit at the right hand of God? It means you're equal with God. To sit at the right hand of a king in those days meant that you were equal with the king. Generally speaking, the only person who sat at the right hand of the king was the queen. Now, these next verses, I could just meditate on these all day. Who will separate us from the love of Messiah? Will tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? Just as it is written, for your sake we are being put to death all day long. We were considered as sheep to be slaughtered. But in all these things we overwhelmingly conquer through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing will be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Messiah Jesus our Lord. That's a pretty secure place to be. And the thing that's interesting about this is, if somebody would look at this and say, let me see if I can come up with something, another thing that's not on this list that could separate us from God. This is not a list of things, it's a list of categories. And anything you can think of that could possibly happen during a person's lifetime will absolutely fit into one of these categories. It's what's called an exhaustive group of categories. For example, it's clear, you see where it says nor height nor depth? That's a figure of speech called a merism. What it's saying is, you can go as high as you want and as low as you want, and there's nothing in between that can separate us from the love of God. From one extreme to the other, nothing can separate us from the love of God. Things present. If you're in a scary situation, you're in the presence of God and He loves you. Things to come. We can face the future with confidence. Powers, height, depth, nor any other created thing. And notice what it says here, neither death nor life. My own life can't separate me from the love of God. The love of God and you are inseparable. It's not possible that you can be separated from the love of God, because if it were, then Messiah's work on the cross would have been incomplete. And it wasn't. Right before he died, he said, "It is finished," which literally translates paid in full. Okay? Let's see where we are now. Okay, that might be a good stopping point, because next comes chapter 34. And I don't think you have 34 in your book, do you? Yeah, I have to go across and see Kiara and see if she has. Because I have 34 and 35 and 36. So I'm going to have to go see what she's printed out and what she hasn't. So